Well, Michael Ward, thanks again for coming. So your latest book was After Humanity, and this book was a guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. And I have read some C.S. Lewis, but this was the hardest one I have read. I found it difficult at times to parse with the Latin and some of the Greek and some of the allusions he was making. So maybe we should start off. Could you just kind of explain what is The Abolition of Man about? Is it different than his other apologetic work?
Yes, The Abolition of Man is about the objectivity of value, whether goodness, truth, and beauty are objective realities in the world that we perceive and discover, or whether they are merely subjective projections of our own preferences and tastes and whims. That's what it's addressing, that question. And Lewis is defending the objectivity of value and attacking subjectivism and saying that subjectivism, if it's embraced, will lead to a very unpleasant conclusion. In other words, it will lead to the abolition of man. That's why he calls the book The Abolition of Man, because that's the destination he foresees if subjectivism is followed in a thoroughgoing fashion. So that's what it's about. And as for its relationship to Lewis's other apologetic works, well, The Abolition of Man is a very philosophical work. It's not actually a religious work. It's not arguing from a theistic or a Christian point of view specifically, nor is it arguing to a theistic or Christian conclusion. It's operating on purely philosophical principles. Lewis himself had studied philosophy at Oxford as an undergraduate, and his first teaching post at Oxford was in philosophy with a specialism in ethics. So he had a keen interest in this question of moral value. We see that in his early lectures at Oxford. If you're wanting to connect it, The Abolition of Man, to his better known works of Christian apologetics, then the place to look is really the opening chapters of Mere Christianity, because there, Mere Christianity begins with a section entitled Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. And in Mere Christianity, Lewis is presenting essentially the same argument about the objectivity of value, except it's done in much more accessible and popular terms. And he proceeds from that philosophical position to defending the idea of God, and then the Christian God in particular.
So this argument for the objectivity of value undergirds or is foundational to where he goes from there to talk about theism and then Christianity. But that's not where he's really going in The Abolition of Man, just philosophical argument. So
that's right. Yes, it's a purely philosophical argument. And he says at one point in the course of The Abolition of Man, though I am myself a theist and indeed a Christian, I'm not attempting here any even indirect argument for theism. So he's setting his sights very low. He's really just advancing a kind of anthropological case. What is it that makes us distinctively human? And his answer is this ability to recognize and act upon objective value. And if we give up on that capacity, or somehow deny its reality, then we are undercutting our own humanity, hence The Abolition of Man.
Lewis was born and raised Anglican, and then kind of fell away from the faith. When was it? Shortly after his mother died? And then
a few years after she died,
And then he fell into a sort of vicious, or suffered a vicious subjectivism on his own, but he slowly grew out of that. What were some of the ways he grew to overcome that subjectivism he suffered from?
Yes, he said that there was at one point in his life a stage when he was confronted with two sort of incompatible perspectives on the world. He said that he was living in a world in which facts without one trace of value confronted feelings without one trace of truth and falsehood. The two hemispheres of his mind, he said, were in sharpest contrast with one another. In other words, he had plenty of value appreciating experiences. You know, he was a very sensitive young man. You know, he was poetic, he was romantic, he had desires, but those feelings were not, in his view at that point, related to truth and falsehood. They just were desires, you know, effectively valueless desires. But on the other hand, he was aware of a world of, as he puts it, atoms and evolution and military service, the brute facts of his experience, which seemed to be valueless. And it was overcoming that dichotomy, bridging that gulf, that occupied him for much of his teenage years and his 20s. And he finally returns to a belief in God in the late 1920s and then becomes a Christian in the early 1930s. And he says it in one place, in a very interesting letter in the 1950s, I think it was that one of the reasons he embraced theism and Christianity was as an escape from solipsism or subjectivism. In other words, this vicious subjectivism that came upon him in his teenage years was, if it was going to be logically pursued to its conclusion, would result in a kind of solipsism. That is to say, Lewis would find himself effectively shut up in his own perspective on the world. His own perceptions would be all that would be available to him, and there would be no meaningful discourse with any other perspective on the world. So how he escapes from that prison is almost a two decades long story, and there are various stages in it which I try to summarize in my book After Humanity. But one of them is that when he came to Oxford as an undergraduate, he encountered various friends, none of whom, he said, by the way, were Christians, who nonetheless recognized the reality of the moral law and were trying to obey it. And these men, he said, were chaste, and they were honest, and they were decent. And Lewis, at that point, he said, he thought about the moral law as a baboon thinks about classical music. But here there were these other chaps who were trying to live an upright life, not by recourse to religious commitments, but just because they thought that they owed it to their humanity. And he was somewhat inspired by their example, and indeed, you know, ashamed of his own lawlessness. So that was one of a number of things that came his way that challenged his subjectivism.
Wow. Yeah, one part in After Humanity that really stood out to me was when you were talking about how he was approaching his prayers and how he was trying to capture and latch onto a feeling of joy. And then it just became a cycle where he would pray for that feeling and he didn't get it. And he started to become detached. And maybe that's when he started to doubt his religion. But then he comes to look along rather than looking at joy. Yes, I hear it is on page 33. Yeah, he says he needs to look along joy to its external source rather than look at joy itself. And then the quoted section is, joy itself, considered simply as an event in my own mind, turned out to be of no value at all. All the value lay in that of which joy was the desiring. And that object, quite clearly, was no state of my own mind or body at all. Inexorably, joy proclaimed, you want, I myself am your want of something other outside, not of you nor any state of you. Thus I understood that in the deepest solitude there is a road right out of the self, a commerce with something which, by refusing to identify itself with any object of the senses, or anything whereof we have biological or social need, or anything imagined, or any state of our own minds, proclaims itself sheerly objective. And that's the end of that quote. But it took me a while to parse that, about especially the line, all the value lay in that of which joy was the desiring. But That made me think of Descartes, how he starts to realize, well, hey, you know, I'm a mind, I don't have all knowledge, but I know other minds or other, you know, leading up before he goes and becomes a theist and then a Christian. How did his service in World War I affect these ideas that come into Abolition of Man?
Yes, that's a very important point, I think. His experiences in World War I, the Great War. He served in the British Army as a second lieutenant. He saw active duty for about 6 months in the trenches of France before he was blown up by friendly fire, as it happens, by a British shell that fell short and killed the man next to him and spattered Lewis full of shrapnel, bits of which he carried around in his body for decades afterwards. And he has sort of had an out-of-body experience. He wrote later that a picture presented itself to his mind of a man dying, and the man who was dying was himself. You know, he sort of looked down upon himself and saw himself breathing his last breath. But of course, he didn't actually die. He came very close, but he survived, and he was invalided back to England, and he spent another 6 months recovering from his war wounds. Now, having come so close to death and having seen men die on the battlefield, he talks about the sitting and the standing corpses that littered the battlefield. He had to wrestle very, very seriously with the question of patriotism and whether it's a good thing to die for one's country. And Lewis was, of course, a classicist, and he knew his Horace, the ancient Roman poet who had famously said, "Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori." It's sweet and fitting to die for one's country. And that Latin tag had recently been put under great interrogation by a couple of British poets. Both these men, Ezra Pound and Wilfred Owen, had critiqued Dulce et decorum est and said, "It's not at all sweet and seemly to die for one's country. It's hellish, it's brutal, it's pointless, it's meaningless." And you can understand why they said that, given the folly and the brutality of the First World War, one of the most pointless wars, or one of the least evidently justifiable wars in human history. And Lewis was possibly aware of these poems by Ezra Pound and Wilfred Owen. We don't know for sure, but whether he was or not, he himself was clearly wrestling with the same traditional approach to patriotism. Could it be? How might it be sweet and fitting to die for one's country? Because the person who dies for his country doesn't get anything out of it. You know, he's dead. And the sweetness and the fittingness really refer to how other people will talk about your death after you're dead. And they won't do that very often, and it will certainly do you no good. So Lewis, you know, quite frankly faces up to the fact that it's not very obvious how it could be sweet and fitting to die for your country. Nonetheless, he says, well, try to imagine a world in which men were admired for throwing down their arms in battle and betraying their comrades in arms and deserting to the enemy side. It's impossible to think of a world in which that would be regarded as good and noble and honorable. And so it becomes for Lewis the critical test, the experimentum crucis, he says, of objective value. Because from the point of the view of the man who dies on the battlefield, the subjective experience, the personal individual experience, is not at all sweet and fitting. It's painful and disastrous for the person who actually gets it in the neck. Nonetheless, it may be objectively good. The subjective experience is horrific, but the objective value may be real. And it's when you come up to a critical test like this that you begin to realize whether you believe in objective value or not, because you're not getting anything out of it yourself. Nonetheless, you should do it. And all of us, you know, at different levels in the moral life are faced with that test of objectivity when, for instance, you know, at a much lower level, we have to tell the truth. And it may be disadvantageous to us to be truthful. You know, we may have to, you know, do a bit of whistleblowing on our boss, or you know, testify in court, you know, to the detriment of a friend. But honesty requires it of us. And unless we're prepared to pay a price for goodness, truth, and beauty, then we're not really believing in objective value. We're just finding these things valuable when they suit us, when it's convenient. But that's not traditional moral human behavior.
Yeah. Is that kind of like moral luck, where,
yeah,
you know, it's, you haven't been challenged or put to the test, so you kind of think, well, I am an honest person, but you haven't really had to be tested, you know, go through that.
Yeah. It's cloistered virtue. Yeah.
Well, let's dive into what was Lewis tackling at the beginning of The Abolition of Man. He talks about the Green Book, and he's not referring to your Green Book, which is, I don't know why I chuckled when I was like, oh, it's green. Why did he make it green? But nonetheless, he has a big issue with this Green Book, the control of language. Can you give some background on that?
Yeah, so The Abolition of Man begins with a discussion of a textbook that used in English language and literature classes, and Lewis calls the book the Green Book. It happened to be green. It happened to be published by Longmans and Green, a publishing house. That might be a sufficient explanation as to why he just calls it the Green Book. But I also think he might be suggesting that it's green in the sense of being naive. It's, you know, when we talk about when I was green in judgment, you know, when I was young and naive, that might be another reason why he calls it that. But in fact, the book was called The Control of Language, as you said, and it was written by a couple of Oxford graduates, actually. They had studied classics at Oxford, both of these men. Anyway, Alec King and Martin Ketley, in this book, they talk about the famous, or they apparently think it to be a famous episode when the romantic poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, great friend of William Wordsworth, looked at a waterfall in the English countryside. And as King and Ketley remark, the exchange that Coleridge had with a fellow tourist at this waterfall was quite illuminating, because one of them wanted to call it sublime, one of them wanted to call it beautiful or pretty. And King and Ketley say, well, what a pointless debate as to whether it's sublime or merely pretty, because there's nothing inherent in the waterfall which, you know, enjoys any kind of transcendental quality of beauty. So it's just a question of how we as individuals respond to it. And if you want to call it sublime, call it sublime. If you want to call it pretty, call it pretty. There's no point in discussing what's the correct term, because, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And there's nothing objective about the waterfall that is worth debating. Now, that's how King and Ketley discuss that matter. And Lewis takes issue with it, partly because he thinks, you know, philosophically, it's just completely haywire. But even worse, it's part of an English language textbook, which young children will be reading in order to work out how to, you know, do literary criticism, literary composition. And they're being fed a very poisonous philosophy under cover of an English language textbook. So that's what gets Lewis's goat. And he uses this as a springboard into his case about objective value and subjectivism. And it's quite a canny way of opening his case, because we can all remember boring textbooks from our school days. And, you know, most adults have the care of children at some level or other, children, grandchildren, godchildren, nephews, nieces. It matters to us how the next generation is raised. And so we've got that responsibility too. So Lewis manages to make this question not just an idle and dry intellectual matter, but a matter of real import about the moral formation of the next generation. Are we going to train up the next generation to have, you know, keen perception about goodness, truth, and beauty? Or are we just going to allow them to sink back into an almost solipsistic subjectivism?
Yeah, I loved how he talked about the duty of the educator isn't to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts. And I think Alec King and Martin Ketley were worried about. It reminds me a little bit of Dickens' book, Hard Times, like Gradgrind. He's like, fact, fact, fact. Get rid of these ideas of fancy. To the little girl, I think she wanted to have horses as her wallpaper, but like, you can't have horses on your walls. That's not a fact. You know, it's just destroying these things because we're rational, and it's probably going to lead to some sort of moral deformation or something like that. But Lewis is saying kids nowadays, it's like, they're more like deserts in a way. They don't have a repository or a moral sense or a vocabulary of right and wrong. And so he dives in, and as he talks about objective value, he uses these different words like the way, the road, natural principles, or first principles of practical reason. And why do you think he settles on the Tao, T-A-O, the Tao, instead of something more Western and philosophical, given his day and age?
Yes, he adopts this term Tao from Confucian philosophy as a way of summing up this repository or reservoir of objective value. It's the way, according to the ancient Chinese philosopher, it's the way the universe goes on, and it's the way that every man should tread in imitation of that great moral exemplar, which is to be found, you know, irradiating the universe. And it's interesting rhetorical move that he uses this Eastern term rather than, as he could have done, a more common Western term like the natural law. Thomas Aquinas, the great Dominican theologian and philosopher, is probably the greatest exponent of natural law philosophy in the Christian tradition. But Lewis never refers to Thomas Aquinas once in the course of this book. And if I've counted correctly, I think he uses the term natural law just once. As you say, he prefers these other terms like the way, the road, first principles of practical reason, and above all, the Tao. And I think one of the reasons he chooses this term is to wrong foot anybody who assumes casually that Lewis is just going to be retreading a standard Christian defense of natural law in a Thomas Aquinas kind of mode. No, 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 Lewis is saying it's not a specifically Christian thing I'm arguing for. It's philosophical, it's anthropological, it's worldwide, it's down through history, and you can see it even in the Chinese. So it's a very canny move to use that label to denote what he's talking about. But interestingly, it's the Tao can be best translated into English as the way. And of course, anybody who's got any biblical knowledge will know that Christianity is also the way, the followers of the way, as the early Christians are called in the book of Acts. And of course, Jesus Christ himself is the way, the truth, and the life. You know, he's the personification. He's the incarnation of this way. So when you begin digging down an inch or two below the apparently philosophical terminology that Lewis is adopting, you find it's deeply consonant with Lewis's Christian commitments. It's just a brilliant rhetorical strategy not to unmask his battery and reveal to his readers, his skeptical readers, his anti or un-Christian non-Christian readers, that everything he's arguing for is entirely compatible with Christianity, even though it doesn't rest upon and isn't dependent upon Christian principles.
It's like those who have eyes to see, they can see it, but it won't be a stumbling block for those who don't have that vision. It's talked about that the Tao is, I think he says, it's the truth beyond all predicates, that it's a starting point. So if it is self-evident, why is subjectivism or emotivism just so enchanting? Or I guess what I'm trying to say is, if it is so self-evident, why does it even need to be taught?
Yeah, very good question. You're quite right. He describes the Tao, this moral law, as self-evident. It's just there. It's axiomatic. It's the thing we start from. We can't argue to it because all argument depends upon it. It's our starting point. We just have to assume it, presuppose it, if we're to get anywhere in any kind of debate about goodness, truth, or beauty. We have to accept that it's bearing upon us before we begin to talk about aesthetics and ethics and rationality, it's self-evident. And if you can't see it, it's a kind of blindness. But to say that it's self-evident is not the same as saying that it's obvious. That's quite a subtle distinction, but an important distinction. It's self-evident, but it's not obvious. And that's why the raising of the next generation is so important, because children need to be ushered into their moral inheritance as human beings by their parents and their teachers and their pastors and their priests and anybody who has any say about how children are raised. Because, I mean, just think of the possibly fictitious examples of the feral child, you know, the Tarzan child who's left in the jungle and raised by wolves. What kind of moral inheritance would he acquire? Well, really none. He would acquire the law of the jungle only, the survival of the fittest. And as we've already been discussing with respect to Dulce et Decorum Est, mere survival is not enough. The right thing for you to do in certain circumstances may be to sacrifice your life for the sake of other people. Literally, maybe, on the battlefield, but in many other smaller ways, sacrificing yourself, you know, putting yourself out for the sake of other people, being honest for the sake of other people, even if it's inconvenient to you, that's what it means to be human. Because we're not just in a nature red in tooth and claw, survival of the fittest, you know, a Darwinian struggle for survival. We are human beings. We are not merely animals. And it's part of our ethical inheritance to acknowledge this fact. And you have to be, as it were, held to it by your parents and teachers in order to be made to see it, so that your eyes open. Just as, you know, in the physical development of a human baby, they don't know how to focus their eyes to begin with. They don't have object permanence in their perceptive powers. So in the moral realm, young babies, young children, likewise, need gradually to acquire the faculties of moral recognition, moral perception. And it's not obvious, but it's self-evident.
Does Lewis give any evidence for the Tao, that it exists?
Well, yes, he has an interesting appendix at the end of The Abolition of Man, in which he lists 8 different moral rules or regulations, such as the duty of general beneficence, the duty of special beneficence, the duty of veracity, magnanimity, and various others. And under each heading, he lists any number of different sources from different moral traditions, different religious traditions, all over the world and down through history, ancient Babylonian, Aboriginal Australian, Norse mythology, Christian, Jewish, Hindu, and various others besides. And he quotes these different sources, all of them testifying to these particular 8 moral laws that he has chosen to focus upon. And that's, if you like, a kind of testimony to the objective reality of the moral law, but they don't prove it. Mm-hmm. As Lewis says in the appendix, I'll just quote you the relevant line. He says, "I'm not trying to prove the validity of the Tao by the argument from common consent. Its validity cannot be deduced. For those who do not perceive its rationality, even universal consent could not prove it." Because, as we've said, it's a starting point. It's an axiom. It shines by its own light. And if you don't see that light, then no amount of argumentation can get you to open your eyes. You're just, unfortunately, morally blind. You're a bit like a sociopath or a lunatic, and your place is not in the human community.
Yeah, it's interesting because those sources in the appendix, like you said, Norse, Muslim, Hindu, Egyptian, Babylonian, etc. It's not that they agree on everything, right? People could say, well, look at all the differences. And you know, here the law was, you know, if you steal, they chop off your hand, or I don't know, something like that. Look at all of the diversity amongst these sources. And is that a weakness or is that a strength?
Well, in a way, it's neither. I think it's just a fact that different traditions, different civilizations have all agreed, for instance, on the fact that, as Lewis puts it, no man should just be able to have whichever woman he wants. So everybody's agreed on that. There are constraints upon sexual behavior, but different traditions come to different conclusions about the number of wives a man might have. So in the Christian tradition, you know, it's one man, one wife, but in, you know, a polygamous tribe, a man can have many wives. And there are, you know, some civilizations where a woman can have more than one husband. But the point is essential to Lewis's case is that they've all recognized a constraint. They've all recognized that sexual behavior has some limits about it. In other words, we're not just rutting animals. We can control our sexual urges, our sexual appetites, and should and must if we are to live in community. Again, this is part of what it means to be a human being, to curb your own instincts for the sake of an objective good that you recognize. But the precise limits of that behavior will differ from community, from tradition to tradition. And Lewis is fully cognizant of the fact that there are many differences separating these traditions, but it's because each tradition recognizes an objective value that you can debate from one tradition to another about which is better.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no such thing as objective value, then there's no point in arguing, for instance, whether, as he puts it in not the abolition of man, but in mere Christianity, there's no point in debating whether, for instance, Christian morality is better or worse than Nazi morality. You know, the Nazis just happen to have their morality, and, you know, they like exterminating Jewish people. And we, you know, you can't say anything against it because, well, that's just how they see the world, isn't it?
But it's of their course, truth. Yeah.
It's their truth. But of course, objective value requires those who are not Nazis to say to the Nazis, you're wrong. You're very, right. Very seriously wrong.
Right. It's not even a morality. And in the Nuremberg trials, the Nazis were saying, well, we didn't do anything wrong. We were following orders. Okay, so we were good soldiers, but it's like, no, you broke the higher law. You were inhuman, and that is why you're on trial here. I think that's so fascinating because with the geographic diversity, ethnic diversity, time, everything, it's what you're saying and what Lewis is saying is that there's a strong overlap of recognition that there are some attitudes that are right to us and to the universe. There are certain things, like you were saying, our sexual behavior that merits a certain response, whether or not we rise to that level or not, it's there. Mm. And that is the thing that binds us as human. Mm. And if we try to chop that away and reject it or to call it something else, instinct or utility or something else, it's futile. That's not a progression. It's the final doom of our humanity that we're chopping down.
Yes, exactly. We can sear our consciences. We can pretend that we don't recognize objective value. And indeed, I mean, all of us do this to a certain extent. Anybody who have any, you know, even modicum of self-awareness will realize that we try to live in a subjectivist frame of mind when it suits us. You know, this is what law breaking is. This is what sin is, to use the Christian term, that we think we can make an exception for ourselves. You know, did God really say you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree? You know, is it really objective? Must I conform myself to this external standard? Is it a reality out there that I need to recognize and conform myself to? Or can I just go my own way? And of course, every time we go our own way, we are effectively turning towards subjectivism, though we tend not to use those philosophical terms in the Christian tradition. But that's effectively what it is, philosophically speaking. And so, you know, to that extent, as, you know, as Lewis points out, we can't just look at the Nazis and say, oh, how terrible. We ought to say, there but for the grace of God go I. You know, that's where all subjectivism, all sin eventuates. That's an extreme case. That's an almost limit case of inhumanity, of the devolution into a subhuman way of living. But that's where it all is pointing.
Is there a place for subjectivism, given that you and I, for example, we have totally different backgrounds and you're from a different continent and we have different perspectives, we have different experiences, and you know, even while recognizing the objectivity of value, that there is truth, is there room or value in our subjective experiences?
Absolutely, yes. And it's only because value is objective that there is value in our subjective perceptions of those objective realities. If there was no objective value, there would be no value to our subjective opinions and tastes and whims and preferences. In other words, you can only, as it were, talk about my truth in any meaningful sense if there is such a thing as truth to which you are approaching and which hopefully you're beginning to learn about in greater and greater detail. But of course, yeah, we all perceive reality from our own perspective, and nobody can occupy precisely that point in the universe which I occupy or which you occupy. And because you are a human being, your perspective matters. What you see, how you perceive, I want to know about, because that will help me to perceive reality more completely. But if there's no joint reality, if there's no common ground that we're all advancing to or moving away from, as it may be, then there's not really much point in my talking to you. What am I talking about?
Yeah.
Because we're all locked up in our subjective solipsistic cells, and therefore human community just evaporates. But so, you know, there is some truth in that old proverb that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, because we do perceive beauty differently, and we do have different tastes, we do have different traditions out of which we operate. But only if there is some objective beauty to behold does it make any sense to say that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You know, what would we mean by beauty? What would we mean by beauty in a subjective, in a thoroughgoing subjectivist world? That word would be a word without meaning.
Mm-hmm. Everything falls apart and words lose their meaning. And yeah, without truth, you can't have true beauty or true tolerance or true respect. It's definitely foundational.
So to come back to the point about waterfalls, you know, the question about whether the waterfall is better described as sublime or pretty is actually a question worth asking, because there are different kinds of waterfall. You know, there's Niagara Falls, and then there's a little trickle in the stream outside my house. And they're both fall, you know, bodies of falling water. And in between Niagara Falls and the little trickle outside my house, there are any number of intermediate kinds of cataracts. And when you begin to assess the proper terminology to describe these different waterfalls, you'll come to a hard case, as it were, to a boundary case where you think, well, this is no longer just pretty or beautiful. This is positively sublime. And you can debate, you can discuss with someone as to whether it is better described with this adjective or that, but only if you're acknowledging that there is some kind of quality inherent in said object, is there any point in having that discussion at all?
Mm-hmm. And it's not just your feeling sublime. That doesn't make sense. The emotivist, or like the Alec King and Martin Ketley school of thought, where it's like, you're just stating your feelings about the thing, not something inherent, like you said, inherent in it. But really, yeah, when he's seeing the sublime waterfall, it's not, I feel sublime. It's, I feel humbled, or I feel awestruck. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, yes, I mean, that's an important point, that our feelings matter. You know, we should not read Lewis in such a way as to suppose that our feelings are somehow unimportant in the assessment of reality. No, 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 no. Part of what it means to be human is to have feelings, not just thoughts. We can identify facts, yes, we can assess the data dispassionately and neutrally and scientifically, but we also are persons. We feel, we love, we desire, we have senses, sentiments, and those are important factors in the total equation of what it means to be human.
So we're capable of thought and rationality. We're also capable of feelings and, you know, appetites. This might be a good time to bring up the chest. So at the very end of Men Without Chests, Lewis says, in a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. What are your thoughts about what he means by men without chest there?
Yes, as you say, there's a trichotomy, a tripartite model of the human person that he's working to there. The head, the chest, and the belly. He's talking about human beings from a philosophical point of view. In the head, we think. That's the place where we can reason and operate logically from premise to middle to conclusion. That's the head. But in the belly, we feel. That's the appetitive side of our nature, where we have desires and longings and guts and blood and senses and all the rest of it. And that's the belly. In the head, we're like the angels. We're rational spirits. In the belly, we're like the animals. We have the viscera and the senses and the blood and the guts. In the chest, we unite the angel and the animal. And that's how we arrive at the anthropological. So the human being, for Lewis, is a combination of the human brain and the human belly in the human breast. The chest is a kind of liaison officer between cerebral man and visceral man. Hmm. We are, to use one, you know, classic description of humanity, we are, as human beings, rational animals. And it's the chest, which is a kind of airlock, as it were, between the head and the belly. That's what allows the head and the belly to live in some sort of harmony with each other. Not like a criminal chained to a policeman. The chest is not just a pair of handcuffs. The chest is more like, well, it's more like that third thing that arises out of the true unity, the true union of two otherwise distinct things. You know, think of it in terms of marriage. The husband and the wife become one flesh. You know, there's a third thing, as it were, that arises out of the true union of distincts. And the chest is that liaison officer, the combining the two elements of our nature that would otherwise not be connected.
And how can we develop our chests, aside from doing, you know, bench press and shoulder press and all that good stuff, which isn't really what he's talking about, but how can we, you know, develop our chests in the way Lewis meant?
Well, one way we can do it is by listening to wiser and better people. You know, we all did this, hopefully, when we were children. We listened to our parents and our grandparents and our teachers, and we followed their advice. And we grew up into our humanity. Our chest was developed because, you know, you can remember your parents saying to you, stand up straight, make sure you're on time at school today. In other words, you know, disciplining your appetites, training your emotions. That's one way in which you do it. But likewise, it's important to not just control your appetites, it's sometimes important to awaken your appetites. You know, a true human being is not just a frigid robot, but has these quite proper desires. And so, you know, another way in which you can train your chest is by exposing yourself to experiences of beauty and, you know, transporting experiences of music and hiking up in the mountains and letting your lungs fill and standing under a starlit night and just observing it and seeing what response it is evoked in you. So it's not just disciplining your appetites, it's also expanding your appetites. And this brings us back to your earlier point about cutting down jungles or irrigating deserts. Cutting down jungles is when you learn to, you know, just stop sniveling, stop indulging your self-pity when you're a kid. But irrigating deserts is when the very limited and cloistered virtue that we were talking about earlier is put under some kind of test or strain or enlarging opportunity. Those are all ways in which we're constantly training our chests. It becomes second nature to us. We hardly realize we're doing it after a certain age has been reached. But every day of our lives, we're either, as it were, being more deliberately rational or more deliberately sensual, in a good sense, I mean. We're learning to be more sensitive. And it's the chest that, like a cyclist on a bicycle is constantly leaning slightly to the left and slightly to the right, slightly to the head, slightly to the belly. That's what it means to be human.
I have friends and family who consider themselves, very religious and very almost not shut. Let me see if I can say this better. They have strong convictions in their religious beliefs, and they know truth as their scriptures or things like that. What kind of a value would there be in them learning about the Tao, or studying and concerning themselves with this? Do you think it's something that someone who's already, say, established in a religion ought to look into?
Yes, I mean it's something that everyone ought to look into, whether they're religious or not, because if we agree with C.S. Lewis, and I think he makes a pretty convincing case, this is a good definition of the human or the humane, and all of us, whatever position we occupy on the question of religion or what sort of religion we practice, are human beings. And this should go without saying. You can only be a religious human being if you're a human being first. So
Yes, yes.
what does it mean to be human? And it means to be a rational animal, to have thoughts and ideas and principles and logic, but also to have senses and appetites and desires. And those senses, appetites, and desires are good things. They're not bad. They're not to be squelched. They are to be developed and trained and honed. And so you become even more capable of desires and ever more refined desires as you grow in your life. But yes, there is, alas, a tendency in some Christian traditions, and indeed in all religious traditions, towards the what would you call it, the stoical or the pharisaical or the legalistic, the idea that you can just organize your life on a set of rules. But it's not just a question of obeying regulations. It's learning that, it's again, C.S. Lewis says those who think that life is about morality haven't begun to understand what life is about. That life is an art. We need the moral law as you need, the axes and ropes in order to mountaineer to the top of the mountain. But the road to the promised land leads past Mount Sinai, as he puts it. Road to the promised land leads past Mount Sinai. You need to get to Mount Sinai and get your Ten Commandments, as it were, but you don't stop there with your clay tablets, as if life is nothing more than a stony regulation. You go on from there to the promised land, the land of Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey, land of sweetness and innocence, and that's where you live. And that's a beautiful way of putting it, I think.
Yeah. And something I've also seen firsthand is when the jewel of truth isn't hardened by testing and thinking in this way that Lewis advances and that your book explains really well, something may happen within their church or their faith, and they get bumped off and everything goes. Their faith held an idea of epistemology and teleology and what is true. It gave them a sense of all of these things, and it was unquestioned. It went untested. And when a bad interaction with a pastor or something like that happens, they fall. And they didn't go to divinity school or they didn't study philosophy, and they probably haven't read this book yet. And it becomes, well, geez, I used to think that was true, but how can I know if anything is true? And they don't actually have this understanding of objective value, that there is truth, capital T truth, and that we can know that there are things. And when that occurs, they fall into a subjectivist almost wasteland, and they suffer from it, and it becomes very difficult. It becomes that vicious subjectivism. So I totally agree. It's if you're a human, you know, this ought to be like, you know, humanities, something to know about yourself.
Absolutely. Yep. That's why philosophy is so important, and anthropology. You need to know what it is to be human before you can know really what it is to be Christian. You know, if Christianity for you is just, you know, a set of moral regulations and social behaviors, yes, quite possibly, indeed, probably, when you come up against some scandal in your church or some major problem in your faith life, it can all collapse like a house of cards. And then you are, as you say, in a kind of wasteland. But if you've already got a bedrock of humaneness, of humanity, undergirding your religiosity, that collapse is less likely to happen. And as Lewis likes to point out, you know, this idea of anthropology, of trying to determine what is common to all human beings, irrespective of their religious commitments, is indeed a Christian position. It's there in the Bible. You know, the most famous example of it is St. Paul's words in the letter to the Romans about those who are without the law, i.e. the Gentiles, nevertheless have the law written on their hearts. And this conscience sometimes absolves them, sometimes condemns them, and they show that the law is there. In other words, it's a creation ordinance to have a conscience, to know the basic essentials of right and wrong. It's not merely a Judaic thing for St. Paul, or, you know, now in the Christian dispensation, it's not just a Christian thing. It's something that Christians and Jews share with everybody at some level.
Yeah. Reading The Abolition of Man, it's kind of a sad ending in a way. But yeah, I think this is a good ending to this. And thank you again for coming. And direct listeners who may be interested, where can they go to learn more about your work and the book?
Thank you. Yes. Well, so the book is called, just to give the title one more time, After Humanity, A Guide to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man. And it's available on Amazon and all good book sellers. It's published by Word on Fire Academic. And it's possible, I think, maybe still, if you go to the publishing website, Word on Fire Academic, you might be able to get a tie-in edition of The Abolition of Man with my book, with matching covers. And that's quite a nice coupling up, if it's still available. I think it is, but listeners can check out on that. And then if you wanted to know a bit more about me, I've got a website, michaelward.net.
Awesome. Well, Michael Ward, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great pleasure.
And for me, thanks, Nate.